If you ever wonder what's happening in the moments when guests are waiting for us for tape segments, not much. That's actor Russell Crowe warming up. He told us about a time backstage when he and the superstar cast of Les Miserables, including Anne Hathaway and Hugh Jackman, sounded like a herd of sheep.
We were all standing around this room, all doing our own separate vocal warm-up. Very odd.
What was yours?
I mainly do...
But then we settled in to talk about his very serious latest project, the film The Water Diviner. It's his first as director. He also stars as an Australian farmer whose three sons are reported killed in action during World War I. He's a diviner, a dowser, so he travels to what's still then the Ottoman Empire, to Gallipoli, to find their bodies. Australian officers also working to identify bodies after the war want to send them home, but the Turkish officer helping his former enemies has a suggestion.
Maybe we could help him until then.
You know what the chances of finding his boys are?
We have the day they were killed. I know the area.
Yeah, we both know it, but why change everything for one father who can't stay put?
Because he's the only father who came looking.
The Water Diviner caused a huge outcry initially. For one thing, Russell Crowe used the word invasion to describe what the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps, or ANZAC, did during the war. But The Water Diviner ultimately won three Australian Academy Awards, and it's breaking box office records there. It opens in the U.S. today. It's filled with history and lush landscapes, whirling dervishes passing through the frame. What will The Water Diviner find? Tomorrow is ANZAC Day, Australia's Memorial Day, originally a commemoration of the men who died at Gallipoli. We asked Russell Crowe the significance of that battle at home.
Well, the significance culturally of Gallipoli is because it's the first time the young nations of Australia and New Zealand fought under their own flags. Prior to then, they'd been involved in Crimea, the Boer War, but as extensions of the British Empire. But they were both federated into independent countries early in the 20th century. And so by the time you get to the beginning of the First World War, 1914, they are now fully independent. And they raised a force of volunteers at the request of the British government. And it became a social cause, you know, where everybody got involved in encouraging people to go. And so, you know, hundreds of thousands of young men put up their hand, but based on the idea that they were sold, which was, think of the adventure. You know, you come from a little outback town or one of the smaller urban centres of Australia, and, you know, you'll get on a boat and you'll go and see the rest of the world.
Yeah. What's the word, the Australian word? Limican?
Larrikin.
Larrikin, for yeah. Sort of daredevil, do anything, right?
Yeah. But, yeah. You know, the thing about that situation is that, you know, a little bit of time goes by and messages start coming back from the front, not just about how many were dying, but the nature and way that they were dying. And people started to re-examine what they'd encouraged their children to get involved in.
Yeah, it was horrific. I mean, Gallipoli in particular, horrific. How did you try to get across something that people may feel they've seen before?
It approaches a subject matter that they do believe that they know, but it gives a perspective that they've never seen. Any of the films about Gallipoli, they focus on the trench-to-trench battles and the charges of the soldiers going over the top. There hasn't been a Gallipoli TV show or movie that actually goes into the fact that, you know, they would invade each other's trenches and it would get down to hands and teeth and knives and get very essential, you know.
We see hand-to-hand combat, bayoneting, and also we see what happens. We actually hear what happens after the fighting.
So many diaries of the young soldiers that were there mention that sound that emanates from no man's land between the trenches after a particular conflict has died down. And nobody ever shows it, you know, because it's not simple. It's not clean. You don't just go over the trench, get a bullet, and you're dead. You know, there's hundreds of wounded men bleeding out through the night. And crying for water and for their mothers and for God.
Hmm. You read the diaries?
Yeah, as part of the preparation for the film.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the broad base on which the film is built. And then you have this storyline, a father who comes looking for three sons. Now, I'm imagining there were families that lost many sons, but mm-hmm. We understand this story actually grew out of a letter that the screenwriter Andrew Anastasios found?
Yeah, Andrew Anastasios is actually reading a memoir by the historian C.W. Bean. And in that, he quotes a letter from a fellow called Lieutenant Colonel Cyril Hughes. Now, Hughes had been a soldier at Gallipoli, so he took on board the responsibility of going to that cold battlefield 4 years after the fact when the First World War actually finished and identifying as many sets of bones as he could and interring them and marking their graves. And in C.W. Bean's book, the quote from the letter is, "One old chap managed to get here from Australia today, searching for his son's grave. We looked after him as best we could, and we put him on a boat to Brindisi." And that sort of exploded in the imagination of Andrew Anastasios. And who was this man?
Was this the first time in modern warfare that two sides came together, or even the one side, the Australian New Zealanders, to look for and bury the dead?
In the British Army, until the First World War, at the end of a conflict, they would simply dig the biggest hole that they could, and they would scrape all the dead bodies and the mules and the horses and whatever else into the hole and cover it over. But because it was such a public war, that thing we were talking about before, about, you know, they engaged the public in encouraging young men to go, they couldn't hide this time.
Let's listen to another scene from the film The Water Diviner. Here your character is talking to a Turkish widow about finding two of your character's son's bodies.
It's good to know where they are. Not lost or nameless anymore. I was told my oldest son was taken prisoner.
So he's alive?
I don't know.
But you have hope?
Hope's a necessity where I come from.
We don't want to give it away, but there is hope that a third son is alive. And there's sort of a mystical aspect to this film. The father, a water diviner. The son may be seeking the divine.
You know, I don't really see Joshua as having any mystical / magical powers, you know. It's just a simple fact that, you know, a very small percentage of people, whether it's some sort of reverse polarity in the body or some sort of magnetism thing, actually can douse water or water divine, you know. I have the character whirling with the dervishes because I was reading and I found out what the whirling was all about. It's about balance. The earth turns, our universe turns. If you want to be at one with the earth and the universe, you should turn. I'm kind of using the whirling of the eldest boy, Arthur, you know, one to call his father, but also he's got things in his heart and his soul that he's trying to forgive himself for.
Have you met dowsers and have you tried whirling?
I have met dowsers, and I know that I'm not one. But my dad has that skill, which is probably why it hit me at a certain place when I was reading the script for the first time. Huh. Now, when I started talking about this, my dad actually called me up and he said, "Oh, would you stop that stuff? I've never found a body of water in my life." And I reminded him, I said, "Look, 1978, we were in Auckland, New Zealand, had recently arrived from Australia. We were heading out to sport one day and we went out the driveway and the council workers were in the street looking for a water leak. My dad went inside and he got a metal coat hanger and he undid it and he shaped it into a Y and he came out onto the street and he went up and down and then he stuck it in the grass at one point and he said, "Gentlemen, the leak's coming from here." And I reminded my dad of that and he goes, "Oh, well, okay, I can find broken pipes." But no, I've never whirled. I had a good look at it for hours and hours and hours and weeks. Actually, I spent watching the guys that do it. But no, if you want to do it seriously, the first thing that they do is hammer a nail between your big toe and your little toe. And you've got to go round and round that nail essentially until it's just blood and, and mashed up skin. Mm. So, you know, it's something I don't think that you enter into lightly.
Well, as we said, there is so much in this film. That's actor and now director Russell Crowe talking about his new film, The Water Diviner. It opens in theaters today. Russell, thank you so much.
Cheers. All the best.